We'll call the special committee on, subcommittee on ANWR from the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. A couple minutes before 10, and it's March the 20th. For the purposes of the hearing, for those people that have not attended our hearings in Anchorage and our Fairbanks and Anchorage, we have four resolutions before the committee: Senate Resolution Number 7, Senate Joint Resolution Number 17, Senate Resolution Number 12, and Senate Resolution Number 13, and those are available if anybody wishes to look at them. One, Senate Resolution 7 is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge Oil and Gas. Senate Joint Resolution 17 is the federal conservation units in the state. Senate Resolution 12 is Canadian oil development in the Arctic. And Senate Resolution 13 is ANWR and the porcupine caribou herd management. Let the record show that Senator Jones, Senator Duncan, and Chairman Senator Coghill are present. Senator Sturgiolowski will be with us this afternoon. The purposes of our hearing are the four resolutions. About the biggest thrust that we have is that we would like to make sure that we disseminate the information on the ANWR subject to the general public, and also to enlighten the subcommittee as to the issues, which are the porcupine herd, caribou herd, the geology, the land trades, the 90-10, and the policy that we have to advise the state on. And today, why we're going to zero in on, in the Ketchikan hearing, on basically on the conveying of federal land exchanges, the whole land subject. We're going to discuss the 90-10, and what we'd like to do to begin with is that we would like to call the federal and the state land exchange experts to the table. And Bruce, I don't have a copy of who's going to be here, but I imagine that that's Gary Gustafson and Tom Custer on the state side, and Mr. Goebel, and just you? Well, that's 3-1. That's
that sounds fair.
Fair?
For the record, I might note this is the first time I think that the state has outnumbered the federal government in any forum where I've been present.
I guess what we'd like to do is just to start out, Gary, with a general. Start out with going around the table and introducing yourself for the record, and then we'll have just a general statement from both of you, and then what we'll do is from any of you, all of you, or collectively or singularly, and then what we'll do is we'll open it up for questions from the committee. So I guess, Tom, we should start with you, so for the record.
Sure. I'm Tom Custer with the Alaska Department of Law. Gary Gustafson, Department of Natural Resources.
Kirk Fredrickson, Division of Governmental Coordination in the Governor's Office.
Good morning, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senators. It's good to be here again today. My name is John Dolan. I'm with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Now, I imagine that probably the first position that we should start out with is to have Gary, do you have a written statement, or John has, I know, and maybe we could start out with the position of the from you, Mr. Doble, and then we can go from there. We can go to the state side, and then we can go back and forth.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Doble. I am here today representing the Alaska region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on matters relating to the potential exchange of oil and gas interests on Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for inholdings in other Alaska refuges. I want to express my appreciation both personally and on behalf of the agency for the committee's interest, patience, and perhaps most of all, perseverance in the conduct of these hearings. Having been a participant and an observer in these hearings for the past 2 weeks, I have been particularly impressed with the commitment to the public's interest that these hearings represent. In our view, the public's interest is best served by the presentation of facts and pertinent planning information relating to the issues before the committee. Speculation and unsubstantiated claims only serve to confuse and mislead both the committee and the public. I am here today to provide the committee with those facts, and I intend to leave associated speculation to others. First, allow me to speak again to the state share in any revenue lease revenues that might be generated as a consequence of congressional action allowing for oil and gas leasing program on what has become known as the 1002 area. For the record, I would like to provide a copy of Assistant Secretary Horn's March 6, 1987 letter to State Representative Sam Cotton. If I could take a moment to do that now,
sure.
I think it might be helpful.
Sure.
I call your attention to the second paragraph of page 5 of Mr. Horn's letter, which outlines the department's position on this issue. I believe you will find that this position is the same position that I represented at the hearing in Fairbanks two weeks ago. Clearly, Congress has the prerogative to establish any revenue sharing formula that in its view best represents the public interest. We understand the state's perspective on this issue and hope this committee appreciates that neither the Fish and Wildlife Service nor the department is in a position to predict the outcome of future congressional action. Mr. Horn's letter also addresses the department's position on the 7I implications of the exchanges now being negotiated. Again, referring to page 5, I believe it's paragraph 1, you will see some discussion of the 7I issue. Since at the present time there is no subsurface component included in the exchange, in our view, there would be no 7I revenue sharing with other native regional corporations. We believe this position is wholly consistent with ANCSCA and the existing agreement between native, regional, and village corporations. However, I think it's probably important to point out that this is an issue that's still under consideration at the departmental level, and I believe that's what Mr. Horn's letter alludes to.
Yes. Yes, we would like to clarify, break in, John, at any time.
Sir,
Senator Jones.
Mr. Chairman, is the reason for the 7I rejection because the land exchange or so-called land exchange at this point is under ANILCA, or why is it outside of ANSCA?
Senator Jones, I guess we have to go back to what the original objectives were for the exchange and how we've pursued those objectives, both from within the agency and the department. The original objective, of course, was to acquire high-priority refuge inholdings that represented and brought with them high public interest attributes, particularly in the form of fish and wildlife resources and public recreational opportunities. As a matter of policy in terms of Fish and Wildlife Service acquisition, we normally, in our acquisition process, do not acquire subsurface. I guess the most obvious reason is that ducks don't nest in the subsurface and people don't recreate in the subsurface. What we have found in our past experience is that if the subsurface is worth virtually nothing, people will give it to you. If they think it's worth something, we normally can't afford it. We have many recent acquisitions in Lower 48, some down in oil and gas country in Louisiana, a recent one in the Chaffalai Basin, where we simply have not acquired the subsurface, and we have acknowledged in that process the prospect that there may in fact be oil and gas development on the refuge as a result of that, and we're willing to live with that under that set of circumstances, because if we were to pursue that subsurface and acquire it, considering the value that's represented there, it would have such an impact in terms of what we're trying to do elsewhere in terms of surface acquisition and acquisition of other lands, we simply can't afford it. And to translate that into the current transaction, what you would find, from my perspective, is that if there were a subsurface component that it was of significant value, that would represent a trade-off in terms of what we're trying to accomplish in terms of both acquiring surface and holdings, number one, and it also represents a trade-off against the subsurface component in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So it comes at a cost to the leasing program too, obviously, and is not wholly responsive, at least from the agency's perspective, to our objectives for the exchange. So again, my understanding is that unless there is a subsurface component, that there would not be a 7i component. And take that one step further, to this point, there has been a limited opportunity, even should we choose to pursue it, because the villages, for example, on Kodiak, don't own the subsurface. They don't have any subsurface to offer. That's 250,000 acres right there. One of the regional corporations and one of the larger players, Doyon, has not offered the subsurface. And we're not in a position to acquire that simply because it's not on the table. So I guess it's safe to say that well over half of the exchange that's presently on the table doesn't have a subsurface component because it's either not there or it's not available. And the remainder, there could be some potential prospects, and that would be out in the Delta area or down on the Kenai. Does that...
All right. As far as the department's concerned, it's not a subsurface issue. But after the land exchange, if that doesn't bar other native corporations from trying to become part of the issue under ASCA. I mean, you're not arguing whether or not other corporations will share in the values.
Well, Senator Jones, I think that the department's position is that they would not, based on the way I understand Assistant Secretary Horn's letter at this point. In other words, unless there is a subsurface component in the exchange, there is no 7i revenue sharing triggered. That's my understanding as a layman. And in order for that to happen, it would take a special congressional action of some sort.
I believe that's right, isn't it? That 7i is strictly the sharing of revenues from subsurface structures, and that's the reason why you're able to deal with Togiak and some of the not regional corporations but village corporations, because all you're dealing with is the surface right, and they're dealing with the subsurface right through Ceres. Is that correct? Is that the way it works?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand your question, but
I think maybe Gary, when we get to
that really might be better better dealt with by somebody else. But one other point I might make is that if there were a 7i component that were to come into the exchange, the way I understand the way this works, and it was a 7i component that didn't constitute much value or didn't bring much value to the exchange, then it wouldn't represent much in the way of 7i revenue sharing either. So there's that that consideration to keep in mind.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Kester, somebody, but didn't I read somewhere just in the past week that this whole 7i question has been submitted to arbitration somehow, that two or three native corporations are pursuing this question?
On
these land exchanges, it's Sea Alaska and a couple other corporations, I think, are trying to get that resolved.
That's right.
And I think that the arbitrator is looking at that.
I don't think it's on land exchanges generally. It's on the ASRC land exchange from 1983.
Oh, okay. Is that what it's talking
about? With the Kaktovik lands. That has been submitted to arbitration. The rationale, as I understand it, that the Department of Interior is using is that when it receives the surface estate from Native corporations, that surface estate is not subject to a 7i revenue sharing application. So therefore, whatever the Native corporation receives in return for giving up that surface estate does not have any different legal requirements applied to what it's getting in return than would originally apply to the surface estate. So if it gets oil and gas interests in the Arctic National Wildlife Range, the theory is that because that is sort of the analog or the quid pro quo for the surface estate, and 7i doesn't apply to the surface estate, similarly 7i doesn't apply to what they get for that surface estate. I think that's the question. The issue with Arctic Slopes land exchange is a little bit different, because in the Arctic Slope land exchange, the parameters for that exchange were really set in ANILCA under 1431, where Arctic Slope was entitled to subsurface under the Kaktovik Village selections. The only difference was the land exchange allowed them to get title sooner. And had they gotten it under 1431, it would have been subject to 7I. And so I think the arbitration there is to try to determine, did they get out of the 7I requirement by doing an exchange rather than waiting for 1431, or is it the same as 1431 and therefore 7I applies?
So the results of this arbitration will not have any impact on whether these whether the current land exchange negotiations are subject to 7I?
Well, they may have some impact, but it's not a directly parallel situation, so that whatever the result of the arbitration is cannot be applied directly to these exchanges if they in fact go forward.
Does that clear it up for you, Senator? Or is it make it worse?
Clear is the fog.
We'll go on then, John. And we'll.
I appreciate that help, my state colleague. And that's my understanding of the way the attorneys would represent our position. A number of questions have been raised concerning the amount of information available to the participants involved in the exchange. We are negotiating with the exchange participants as private property owners and have no direct knowledge of the information available to the participants or the strategies they might use to identify tracts on the 1002 area. However, we believe the tract identification procedures now being developed are fair to all participants. These procedures will result in tentative tract identifications that will be realized only to the extent that the Secretary and Congress take appropriate follow-up action in support of the exchanges. The tract identification procedure calls for each of the participants to nominate a small number of tracts. These nominations will each be assigned a value based on the department's assessment of their individual oil and gas potential. All of the nominations will then be lumped together to form a selection pool. On the day of tract identification, each of the participants will be allowed to identify any tract in the pool regardless of who nominated it. Identifications will proceed on a round-by-round basis until each participant has identified tracts of comparable value to the value of their inholdings offered in exchange. Hence, participants have the opportunity to execute an identification strategy that is not entirely dependent on their own subsurface information and associated nominations. The amount of subsurface resources that might ultimately be exchanged is another subject of legitimate concern to the committee and others. While no one can predict the percentage of subsurface values involved, the department's objective is to preserve the bulk of those values for utilization or disposition through a traditional lease sale. Several options have been suggested to the committee as alternatives to the exchange concept now being pursued. However, the practical consideration of these alternatives are not responsive to the needs of either the seller, in this case Native corporations, or the buyer, that is the U.S. government. The Native corporations, based on their independent judgments, have concluded that the exchange concept is most responsive, that the present exchange concept is most responsive to their corporate needs. Consequently, they have offered to, quote, sell, unquote, on this basis. From the department's perspective, the existing concept is most responsive to the early acquisition of high-priority refuge inholdings. In addition, should the Secretary recommend and Congress approve opening the 1002 area to oil and gas activities, then the exchange participants would have the opportunity to pursue exploration activities in advance of a lease sale. This prospect is potentially beneficial in two ways. Number one, exploration would be conducted on a limited, closely coordinated basis, thereby minimizing environmental impacts. And two, experience and data, and when I say data, I'm talking about well data and other forms of data, gained through early exploration would allow for a better designed lease sale that may result in higher revenues being generated while further minimizing adverse environmental effects. Thus, the current exchange concept is most responsive to the needs of both the seller and the buyer. In closing, I would like to direct your attention to the maps that provide a visual context in which to assess the relative importance of the exchanges now being proposed. Those are the two maps that are on the wall, on the sidewall here. The large map of the United States, and of course, as usual, Alaska is not to scale on that, indicates where all the national wildlife refuges are located within the 50 states and some of the territories. There are over 430 refuges comprising about 90 million acres in the National Wildlife Refuge System. In Alaska, there are 16 refuges that are comprised of 77 million acres. So out of the 90 million acres in the refuge system, 77 million acres are located within the state of Alaska. The yellow areas on the state of Alaska map there represent the exterior boundaries of the 16 existing refuges, and the black indicates the inholdings, the presently existing inholdings within those refuges. The 13 to 15 million acres of private inholdings in Alaska represent the same amount of lands making up the entire refuge system in the lower 48. So what I'm saying is that if you look at the map to your right, all of the green areas on that map collectively represent the same amount of acreage that is represented in the black on the map of the state of Alaska. That gives you some sense, I think, of the relative importance of inholding and inholding acquisitions within this state, at least from our perspective. The over 1 million acres of exchanges now being negotiated represent about 8% of the highest valued inholdings in Alaska. And I guess a similar comparison could be made that if we were to be pursuing a similar exchange in the lower 48, that it would represent an expansion of the system of 8% for the entire lower 48. It is the largest and most significant exchange transaction ever undertaken on behalf of the refuge system. Speaking as someone who has been closely associated with the refuge system for 25 years, I believe that after all the oil and gas in Alaska has been pursued, developed, and consumed, that this single exchange effort could stand as a lasting testimony to our commitment, wisdom, and foresight on behalf of future generations. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what kind of answer you can give to this, but I'm just wondering, can you comment at all on the suit that's been filed by the environmental groups and the impact? Can you just give us kind of a briefing of what is all involved there? Or do you know any more than we know from what we've heard on the radio?
Senator Duncan, I haven't even heard anything about it on the radio. I understand that a suit has been filed, but beyond that, I probably know less than anyone in this room about the substance of that.
We have just heard that it was filed. We haven't, and I don't know if anybody at the table knows what the structure of the suit is, whether it's on procedure or whether it's on opening up or closing the meetings or just what it is. I've heard that it has to do with that they're wanting the Interior Department to come out in the open with their dealings with the native groups is what I've heard. And I guess that was one of the questions that I had, John, is that, and I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but what is the time schedule? As I understand it from our previous hearings, that the go no go has nothing to do with the land exchanges. The land exchanges come on a little later. That the secretary's position to say yes, we are going to open up the coastal plain has nothing really to do with the. It might have in the background, but the schedule is to have the secretary's going to make that decision first. Then the decision will be made on the process for the land exchange. Is that correct?
Senator Coghill, I think that's correct, and I think that's iterated in Bill Horn's letter to Representative
correct.
Cotton.
Yeah.
It makes it very clear that the secretary's decision is independent from any of the exchange negotiations or even this exchange concepts that are now being pursued.
Well, one of the keys that we have, and I guess it's the time frame. Let I tell you, maybe the best thing for us to do is not to get ahead of the team here. We'll go ahead and have Gary Gustafson or Tom or whoever is going to. If you've got something that you'd like to add, you made a very excellent statement in Anchorage, Gary. I thought that was very concise. Maybe you might want to do something now, and then what we'll do is we'll get into some questions kind of that would be able to be answered by both, and maybe we can come to some conclusion.
Be pleased to, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. On behalf of my colleagues, Kester and Fredrickson, we're pleased to be here this morning. It's always useful to be able to enhance the information base on a very complex subject, and this is certainly something that fits that category. Also like to extend our appreciation to Senator Jones for hospitality and beautiful Ketchikan. It's always nice to be here. And it's not raining.
Nothing to it, really. It's always like this.
Always like this?
Oh, sure.
On command.
Last Saturday morning, I presented a prepared statement for the record. That statement dealt specifically with the issues of revenue implications to the state of Alaska, as well as mentioning several alternatives to the current exchange format. Today, I'd like to go into a little more detail on the specifics of the state's reasons for withdrawing from the exchange table, because I know that that's an issue that probably requires further clarification. The governor has reviewed the trade proposal in the context of the state as both proprietor and sovereign. On both counts, he has concluded that the trades in their present format do not properly address or protect state interests. More specifically, the trades present the following concerns and problems. First of all, Congress is the entity solely responsible for ultimate decisions on whether any land trades will proceed. Based upon discussions with congressional leaders and their staffs in Washington, D.C., the governor has concluded that there is not widespread support for the trades in Congress. The congressional forum will give the state adequate opportunity to protect its interests. Secondly, the proposed trades may have an adverse influence upon the state's paramount ANWR objective, and that is to achieve congressional approval for opening the 1002 area to oil and gas exploration and development. The state's efforts should be directed towards facilitating this opening goal process through the implementation of the governor's ANWR advocacy program. The trades add a layer of unnecessary complexity to this process. Third, the exchanges increase the risk that subsequent federal lease sale bonus bids will be devalued. Based upon industry information, native corporations could select and obtain the most economically valuable tracts through the proposed trade. As a result, exploration would get underway earlier in these areas than on surrounding land retained by the federal government. Therefore, bonus bids on the remaining federal tracts would probably be deflated with corresponding loss to state revenue. That's assuming the federal government then leased them. The timing of the proposed trades is premature. If any trades are to occur, they should only be pursued after Congress acts to open the 1002 area. The present trade schedule calls for agreements in principle on the contract and land use stipulations and ANWR track selection to occur before congressional action on ANWR, and perhaps even before the Secretary makes his final 1002 recommendation to Congress. At the time the state withdrew from the negotiation table, track selection was expected within a matter of weeks.
Gary, could I break in for a minute? Do you have copies available? This is highly technical. You're going, and I was going to start trying to track you on some of those things, and maybe if we could have, do you have copies of your statement?
What I would like to do is because...
Make the statement, and then we'll go back over.
I'd like to make the statement, and with your concurrence, I'd like to make it available for the record and enter it into the record on Monday rather than today. And I say that because this statement was evolved somewhat yet this morning, and I'd like to have it typed up in its entirety so it's a complete record for you.
Sure, fine. It's just that you're traveling pretty fast on a fast track there. Go ahead.
I'll try and at least stay on the same track for
there
you.
There you are.
I'd also be pleased to stop or back up whenever you think it's appropriate. The state participated until recently in the trade negotiations to ascertain whether the trades might be structured in a manner which best meets state interests and objectives. While the state's participation was somewhat successful in enhancing our information base, the state returned from the negotiation table convinced that under the current terms and time frame, it would be impossible to sufficiently alter the process to meet these objectives. While the state did achieve some progress with respect to the size and value of the state lands proposed for trade, the Department of Interior was unwilling to accede with respect to many important components of the exchange contract, the land use stipulations, and the overall time frame. Land exchanges in Anwar would preempt state revenues. Under existing law, the state of Alaska is entitled to 90% of all revenues derived from federal oil and gas leasing and national wildlife refuges, including Anwar. The exchange of Anwar oil and gas interests to native corporations would remove these interests from federal ownership and bar the state from any revenue, since these areas would not be leased then by the federal government. The state has consistently maintained that the 90% revenue share allocation must be protected. And Tom Custer is here, of course, to amply explain the state's posture relative to the 90-10 formula. The exchanges do not appear to be subject to the revenue sharing provision contained in Section 7I of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which was just mentioned here a minute ago. Section 7I requires that 70% of all revenue obtained by Native regional corporations, management of the subsurface land estate, be redistributed equally among the other regional corporations, of which there are 12. Because the proposed trades do not involve any regional subsurface estate, it does not therefore appear that Section 7I would apply. This means the trades would benefit only those corporations which participate. There is simply not enough reliable subsurface data available in the 1002 area upon which to adequately base subsurface values for the purposes of an exchange. The seismic grid surveys completed during the winters of 83-84 and 84-85 are simply too gross to be very meaningful. These data are inadequate to delineate the presence, for instance, of such potential oil fields the size of a Milne Point or a Duck Island. Furthermore, it is known that at least two of the five Native Corporation trade participants have the Kick Oil information. Although the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission also has this information, it must remain confidential and unavailable for either the state or federal governments. This adds to the risk that the state would endure if it participated in a trade process. Finally, the Department of Interior proposes to exchange Anwar oil and gas tracts to Native corporations where the state of Alaska has title claims to the beds of navigable water bodies. In addition, the Native corporations propose to trade the Department of Interior submerged lands where there have been no navigability determinations. Therefore, it is quite likely that the Natives will be trading some land and receiving a corresponding value from the Department of Interior, which may ultimately belong to the state of Alaska. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the formal testimony, and the three of us obviously are here at your leisure.
What legal options, let me start off, Gary, what legal options does the state have to stop the land exchanges, where you don't want to necessarily stop the Anwar, the Arctic Plain from opening up? Do you have a method where the best interests of the state can be protected by, is there a way that you can stop the land exchanges from going forward, and can you make them come out in the open and do what we in the legislature have to do, and that's have open meeting laws?
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, the state very closely monitors this whole situation. It's our feeling right now, based upon a number of discussions in Washington, D.C., that the trades are going to fail of their own accord. However, since you asked the question, what could we legally do, I think I'll have our legal advisor answer it.
I think it depends, Mr. Chairman. If the trades go to Congress, the first step that we obviously would take in the event it ultimately is determined that these are counterproductive, either from the standpoint of the state's primary objective, which is opening the Arctic National Wildlife Range to responsible oil and gas exploration and development, or are so inimical to the state interest that it would be worth attempting to stop them, even if the price was not to open the refuge. Our first avenue would be in Congress itself. Failing action in Congress, there would remain a number of at least potential legal challenges that we could mount. One would be to stop them on the grounds that they're purporting to exchange state-owned submerged lands underlying navigable waters, lands that we believe belong to the state under the Equal Footing Doctrine. Other options would be to look for compliance with any applicable federal statute which was not waived by Congress in the approval of those exchanges. such as the Endangered Species Act, NEPA, Coastal Zone Management Consistency, a variety of other federal acts. In the event that the Department of Interior determines that it's going to proceed administratively without taking these exchanges to Congress, then another variety of legal challenges present themselves, procedural challenges as well as substantive challenges. The paradigm may be the St. Matthew Island land exchange, which was proposed between Syria and the Department of Interior and was halted in court on the grounds that the national interest finding by the Secretary, that in fact was in the national interest to go forward with that exchange, was simply not borne out by evidence in the record. And in fact, quite the contrary was true, and that exchange did not go forward. So I think we have to recognize that part of the legal options available to us hinge on whether or not these exchanges are presented to Congress and Congress in fact approves them. If Congress approves the exchanges, there are fewer legal options available to us, but we are not totally precluded, particularly with respect to the submerged lands. That's one that Congress cannot waive. It's a right that the state got as an incident of statehood, an inherent attribute of statehood.
Well, if they waive the 90-10 and they fiddle with the 90-10 formula, which is part of the compact on the statehood, how come they can't fiddle with the submerged lands, said Tom?
Well, as you know, our view is that they cannot fiddle with the 90-10.
Yeah, well,
I mean, that's we believe that that's quite clear. If they attempt to fiddle with the 90-10, then we would have to assess our options at that point in time and determine what is in the state's best interest at that point. But at this point, it's the state's position that they cannot fiddle with it without our consent. We are not consenting, and that's a given. That's one of the parameters of the debate that we'll have to go forward.
Because as I understand it, Tom, the structure that we're talking about, the one that the kick well is in, goes quite a ways out into the coastal plain, out into the submerged lands. Isn't that correct?
I don't know what the geology shows. That may well be. Obviously, the subsurface does not depend on surface configuration, at least in the kind of degree that we're talking about here. It might well go out into
it goes quite a ways
into the offshore area, which are clearly state-owned submerged lands, at least out to 3 miles. And as the committee probably knows, we're currently in litigation with the federal government over ownership of the tidally influenced lagoons between the mainland and the nearshore barrier islands. You'll notice there are long, slender barrier islands immediately adjacent to the mainland along most of the coast of the Arctic National Wildlife Range. And we're currently in court litigating title to the beds of those lagoons.
Oh, you got one up there. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jones.
Mr. Custer, are you aware that Congress in 1943, 1958, and 1960 took actions to remove the ANWR area from any mineral leasing?
I wasn't aware that Congress did it. I know in 1943, in Public Land Order 82.
Well, that's right. Public land orders. There were three public land orders.
Right, which were promulgated by the Secretary of the Interior.
Every one of them addressed that. Do you still feel that with those actions that we're standing on firm ground from the 90-10?
Absolutely. The Secretary of the Interior can remove them from mineral leasing. That doesn't in any way minimize the fact that Congress is the one that sets the policy. Congress has enacted the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920, providing for a, generally speaking, 90% revenue share going to the states, either directly or through the Reclamation Fund, and 10% to the federal government. And what Congress says controls the Secretary of Interior's discretion. The fact that the Secretary of Interior can remove an area from leasing under the mineral leasing law does not mean that if it ultimately is leased, the mineral leasing law is not the one that will apply. It simply means that the Secretary has determined in those public land orders, I'm not going to use my authority under the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920 to lease this area. If he changes his mind, then his authority for leasing is the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920. So the fact that the Secretary of Interior has removed them administratively doesn't change the ground rules that Congress has set for leasing. Those are the ground rules that Congress has set. The fact that he removes them from leasing administratively doesn't change the fact that Congress made the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920 a provision of the statement compact. It's there. So if leasing goes forward, it's our view that it goes forward under the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920 and the 90-10 revenue sharing formula applies. Okay.
Well, I guess I want to go back, I guess, Tom, to, and I got questions for both of you on the legal aspects again. So what we're saying here is that if Interior is going to go ahead with its negotiations on an agreement in principle, and the state, has the state been at the table on the agreement of principles of in the principle of how the exchanges are going to be, go about, come about, the opportunities that the state has had to participate in those exchanges up to a certain point? Was Bill Horn involved in this? Was he at the table? And then we decided to pull away from him because those principles in the exchange were the places where it was too rigid. And this was the area where that we felt that we were getting rolled.
Mr. Chairman, the state participated in three formal week-long negotiation sessions during which the land exchange contract in its draft form was discussed at some lengthy discussion on my end. Those occurred in December and then twice in February. In fact, the last week was the week before the state withdrew from the table. The state, as I articulated, did have a number of concerns with the substance of the draft contract. The draft contract is actually an agreement that originated between CONIAG and the Department of Interior that is called collectively the boilerplate contract, of which it's a generic contract that the main points of which would be used for all exchange participants and then would be altered to fit the circumstances for the individuals when it came time to agree in principle with the individual trade participants. We articulated a number of concerns that we had with that draft contract, and to be quite fair, some progress was made on a few of those points, and no progress was made on other points. That is also just part of the reason, as I mentioned, why the state felt necessary to withdraw from the table.
That's the reason why I asked you for your paper, because it was fast track, and there were some things in there that we'll get back to.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Could I offer some clarification, perhaps, for the benefit of the committee? It's a little bit, I guess, disappointing to me personally to hear the state represent their treatment at the negotiating table in the manner in which it's been represented here today, because as far as I'm personally concerned, there were never any firm deadlines that caused the state or put undue pressure on the state in terms of having to either meet a deadline or being excluded from the exchange. I can tell you that there are deadlines set every month to get things accomplished, and very few of us have ever met those deadlines, and there would be none of us at the table if that were a hard and fast criteria. It's like in any transaction of this nature. We set deadlines. We try to meet those deadlines in good faith, but many times we don't meet those deadlines. So there was never, I don't think, and I think, in fact, the governor's representative, John Cass, testified at the hearings that were held in Juneau by Representative Cotton's committee to the effect that we had not been rigid in terms of our pursuit of deadlines, that we had shown flexibility, and we continue to show flexibility. I would point out that I have just recently received a new draft of the contract. It's 80 pages long, and it's dated the 13th or the 16th of March, and it was prepared by our solicitor's office in Washington. And it's an underlined version. I would be glad to let members of the committee scan it, although I'm not at liberty to make a distribution of that document. But I think the point is that this document probably has, and I can see just by leaping through it, probably somewhere between 10 and 20% of the language is still being revised and is still under consideration. So at no point have we said, this is the date by which all the negotiations are going to be completed, and if you're not ready to go at that point, we're going to move forward. I think we have continued to be flexible. We've tried to accommodate everybody. We've tried to bring everybody forward collectively in this effort, including the state. And I, as I said before, I'm disappointed to hear my state colleagues represent something other than that, because I think, in fairness, that simply has not been the case.
Okay. Thank you, John. Gary?
Mr. Chairman, John Doble is correct in his representation of that situation. My statement dealt not so much with time frame. I mentioned time frame as one of several considerations. John and I have participated in this process now for quite a number of months, and both of us came to realize that all of the time frames, in fact, I think that originally set had to be exceeded. And it's a very complex process, and when you've got, in this case, six participants, it's very difficult to reach agreement on the number of issues that are at stake on the table. So he is absolutely correct in that representation. My comments were directed more towards some of the substantive provisions of the contract, of which there are many, many parts. As he mentioned, it's an 80-page document. There are all kinds of things in there. There are a number of issues that we raised dealing with, for instance, drainage, the authority of federal versus state interests, who does unitization, the actual interest the state of Alaska might acquire through this, are they sufficient for such things as subsequent state leasing, the terms of the subsistence easement, do they preempt state authorities, appropriation of state water rights, the list goes on. It's those kinds of things that
But Gary, I guess that brings the flag right up like this, is that why wouldn't it be better for you to be at the table pounding away at them on those issues than to leave the table and let them do their own thing? And I guess this is part of my history in territorial government and affairs and getting the country going into statehood and all the rest of it. It seems that so many times Alaskans have not had the privilege to be at the table, and here we're backing away from the table. And you don't have to answer that if that's a policy question, but it's an observation that brings that flag right up. With all of these issues, we'd like to see a copy of, if we could get it, of all of those issues that you just were listing, because I think that's probably the key to a lot of this.
Mr. Chairman, it's like many other things. It's a combination of factors, and you know, again, for the record, because I've said it before, both today and last week and in Fairbanks, the governor's rationale for withdrawing from the exchange table were a whole number of cards to make up the hand, and not the least of which, of course, is the fact that 90-10 is something that the state feels very, very strongly about. Secondly, as the governor mentioned in his press release, the nature of the information was not sufficient upon which to base a trade. And third, that these trades, after having gone back to D.C. personally and talked to the folks back there, the governor was convinced that the trades were not going to occur. The likelihood was not very great. And he wants to focus the state's energies and attention upon opening the coastal plain. That's the foremost goal of this administration. And the exchanges add a degree of complexity and unnecessary divisiveness within this state that he feels is very dangerous.
Tom, did you want to add something?
If I can just might add, I think you have to look, or recall at least, that the negotiations, as far as the state was concerned, had two different aspects. One was the state as potential trade participant, in other words, the state as proprietary landowner. And the administration was aware of AS 3850, the exchange law that we have been instructed by the legislature to comply with as a proprietor in entering into a land exchange. In addition, my department had significant problems with the exchange agreement as it would have been used in any trade that the state participated in. And some progress was admittedly being made on that front, although it was slow, it was grudging, and it was very difficult. But that would not have been a reason to pull away from the table, in my view, because we could have kept working in that regard. The other aspect of the negotiations, though, were the states sitting at the table as sovereign, attempting to protect sovereign state interests. All the things that Gary mentioned, subsistence, the subsistence rights of all Alaskans, water rights, navigable waters, 90-10 revenue sharing, all these other, a number or a host of state federal issues, preemption of oil and gas regulatory authority and so on. And although I wasn't at the table, on some of those issues, progress simply was not being made. And in fact, it was very clear that progress could not be made, either because there was a reluctance or that it was determined that certain parameters of the exchange, basic principles, had already been agreed upon between the Department of the Interior and the Native corporations, and they would not go back and renegotiate them. I know that there's been some significant personal dismay, if I may parallel Mr. Doble's comment, with Mr. Horn's statement in his letter that the state has never formally requested consideration of an overriding royalty as an alternative to the 90-10 revenue sharing arrangement in the event of a Native exchange.
Where is that at, Tom?
Page 5.
I've read it, but last paragraph.
The last paragraph, right. And maybe we misunderstand what Mr. Horn means by no formal request, but there can be no doubt that this was the subject of very intensive discussions with Mr. Horn personally, between John Katz and Mr. Horn. In fact, Gary was there. And we were, in effect, told in no uncertain terms that is not going to be entertained. It simply will not be entertained. Wow. And if you can't get that at the negotiating table, then you have to look for other ways to protect your interest. And that, in fact, is what the state is doing. I would venture a guess, at least, having not been there, that similar results were obtained with a number of the other issues the state was concerned about. As Gary indicated, there was some progress made. But at some point, you have to make a decision, is the progress that you're making and the potential for progress sufficient to keep going? Or do you look for alternative ways to protect your interest? And I think at this point, in addition to the other sovereign concerns exemplified or described by Gary in his paper, the only reasonable decision was the one the governor made, and that was the state is not advancing its state interests by negotiating at the table, and that there is little, if any, likelihood that it will. And so we are going to have to look for alternative ways to protect our interests.
All right, Tom, then you read down there further on that, and it says, such a benefit would be tantamount to the grant, to a grant to the state, and therefore would require federal legislation. Are they saying that an overriding royalty issue would have to have further federal legislation? Is that what they're saying then?
I think that's what Mr. Horn is saying. I think if there had been some willingness to include that as a part of the exchange package, which is going to go to Congress anyway, then that would have been a very strong incentive for us to stay at the table. But there was no such incentive. In fact, it was categorically explained that would not be considered a part of this package.
Okay. Well, we don't have that in writing, but maybe we can get that. John, do you have it? Do you know why there's the opposition to overriding?
Senator Coghill, I have not personally been involved in any discussion of overriding royalty as a part of the negotiation. If there were discussions, they were individual discussions between representatives from the state and the Assistant Secretary's office. So I can't speak to that, and from my personal perspective, the first time I believe I heard of the issue and heard it discussed was at the Juneau hearings when it was raised, and I believe the governor's representative, John Katz, responded to it. So it's not an issue of long standing, and to my knowledge, it's not an issue that I can't characterize, I guess,
just
either the way in which it was treated by the Assistant Secretary or representatives from the state. But I would like to make one additional point, and that is that you know, at no point in the negotiations with any members of the exchange participants, including the state, to my knowledge, do we ever sit around a table and say, we've reached an impasse on this particular point or issue and we're not going to discuss it any further. That's simply not the way you negotiate, or at least not in my experience. You continue to talk, you continue to work, and our objective was to acquire high refuge in holdings of high priority, and the state has those sorts of plans. And I think it was clearly represented to the state on a number of occasions, both by the Assistant Secretary and by members of the negotiating team, that it was our hope that they would stay at the table. And to my knowledge, there was never any line drawn and said, you either, you know, we're not going any further on this particular issue, or if you don't meet this deadline, the state would no longer be a participant. We were simply trying to negotiate, and sometimes negotiations are slow. We've been negotiating with some of the Native corporations for in earnest, I guess, for 9 months, and we're still negotiating with them, and I dare say that some of them would represent at the table, and we don't have agreements on some major issues from their perspective, but that's the form of the negotiations take, I'm afraid, and they are timely.
So this is a new, to your, you've been at the table, haven't you, John, on most of the negotiations?
Yes, sir, Senator.
And so this is a new issue that's just surfaced.
Well, it's new to the extent that the first time that I heard about it personally was in the Juneau testimony that was provided by John Katz, and I think the term that was used there was that there had been repeated requests. And of course, that took place on February 13th, I believe, that hearing. And it personally was a surprise to me to hear that characterized in that way, because that was the first time I had heard about it.
Let me ask another question in this context then. So if the secretary comes out with his decree and he says that the coastal plain shall be open for exploration and for oil exploration and leasing, at that time does it not? And then I have a question to ask you about the time frame, but at that particular point, then that is an offer to the state and to the industry and to the public that these federal lands are now going to be offered for oil and gas leasing. So therefore, we would automatically be in the 90-10 posture at that particular time. Is that correct?
Senator,
you understand what I'm trying to...
I'm not sure I'm in a position to speak to what the Secretary's recommendation will look like in the final report.
We don't know.
But I think if it follows upon the information before this committee in the form of Assistant Secretary Horn's comments in responding to Representative Cotton, I would expect that it would simply leave that issue to Congress, and it won't take a position on that, but that's
his recommendation. I mean, he can't open it. He has to recommend it. That's as I understand. So say he recommends that half of it opens, or that we have this mythical core areas and all of these things that are all part of what we're trying to sort out for ourselves to get some kind of a policy, is that as he goes forward with that, and if he says we're going to open it up, we're going to open half of it, we're going to do this or we're going to do that, he takes that to Congress. Congress passes that, doesn't that automatically put federal land into a posture of being leased under the Mineral Leasing Act, unless there's a bill going to Congress, that there's a definite stipulation that the Mineral Leasing Act is void and null, and this is on oil, shale, or some other, there's two or three things in here that we've been, there's two or three reasons that Senator Jones brought out, public land orders that preclude that. But unless he specifically denies the Mineral Leasing Act, why, then automatically at that time, it's all on the table, it's a federal offer. When Congress passes it, why Congress passes it with that stipulation, then the land trades and all of that is a part of a negotiation thing that's going to come along behind it to go to Congress, and that's really an offer in lieu of dollars and leases and stuff like that, as I understand. I'm just trying to make sure that we've got our sequence. So I guess as we get from that point to the point there, when we come in with all of the land trades and the leases and stuff like that, unless it's specifically denied by the mineral leasing law, we're at a 90-10 posture. Is that correct?
Senator Caulfield, I'm not an attorney, and I wouldn't choose to make a legal interpretation. I think clearly the position of the department is that it is a congressional prerogative. I don't know the answer to your question, I guess. Perhaps,
Gary?
We support your interpretation, Mr. Chairman.
I think your interpretation is absolutely correct. If the provisions in ANILCA which currently prohibit leasing in the Arctic National Wildlife Range are simply repealed so that the congressional prohibition is repealed,
that's right,
then there may or may not be public land orders which would preclude it. But if those public land orders were then revoked by the Secretary, the authority he would have for leasing would be the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920.
That's right.
And I guess this is perhaps one of the troubling things, is that under our analysis and the historic background of the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920. Particularly its incorporation in the Alaska Statehood Act, we believe that it's a very strong federalist position and a very strong states' rights position to maintain that that's precisely what ought to happen. And the fact that there has been this sort of disagreement, as expressed in Secretary Horn's letter, that it's up to plenary congressional discretion, according to the federal executive, and we're the ones that are sort of screaming in the wilderness, if you will, that it may not be up to plenary congressional discretion, because it is part of our right as a state. It does create a philosophic difference, if you will, between ourselves and the Department of the Interior. I think the concept of an overriding royalty was at least one attempt at a creative third alternative, which could both protect the state's interest, protect our interest under the Statehood Act, preserve the principles of federalism, and hopefully allow this process to advance so that we could continue to go forward. And as I indicated, my understanding is that was dismissed as not being
a principle that would be entertained.
As I understand it, the congressional delegation was told the same thing.
Senator Coghill,
yes.
Can I speak briefly to the overriding state royalty aspect, if you will, to the exchange concept and what that implies, because I'm not sure it's clear at this point. The way I understand it, if there were to be an overriding sharing in this exchange transaction that essentially is between the federal government and private native corporations, then there would have to be built into the value equation from the native perspective a consideration for that. And what that in effect would do then, it would lower the value of the tracts that we were offering on the Arctic. And in the course of lowering those values, it would increase the amount of land they would consume in the exchange transaction. So in other words, if they've got $10 million on one side of the equation that represents their value to them as a private corporation, as a private landowner, and they say, we want to exchange this out for $10 million worth of subsurface resources on the Arctic, and we say, yes, that's fine, but we want you to share in the any royalties that might come out of that or any other form of compensation with the state, they'd say, fine and dandy. We'll be more than happy to do that, but that should be reflected then in the value of what we receive, and we would receive more. So there's some contradiction here in terms of what's actually being represented, because the native corporations would have every reason to expect value for value. And if we build in a grant, if you will, to the state, then the lands up there would be devalued, and instead of a small portion potentially of the Arctic being exchanged away, you would see a larger, an incremental increase that would reflect that override.
Tom? If I may just respond, what we are trying to do is to retain the grant that we've already gotten. In other words, current law provides the state gets 90% of the economic benefits from federal lands in Alaska. And what this exchange would do is take 100% of that value and trade it away.
But
that includes the federal government's 10% and the state's 90%. So all we're looking for with the overriding royalty concept is an alternative way of preserving the same grant which we already have. This would not be anything new.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think, though, that that changes the position that I represented. Mm-hmm. Even if we were to agree with that position, the effect would be the same as I think I represented it.
Yeah, well, we understand, and we got another scenario that will go down the line. Senator Duncan.
Well, I didn't want to interrupt this debate here. I guess the state and feds here are finally discussing overriding royalty. You say it wasn't at the table before, and Gary, you say it was. What's right? Was it or
well,
was it not?
I can tell you, the first week of February, I personally attended a meeting with John Katz in Assistant Secretary Bill Horn's office. With the assistant
Let's
secretary.
Stop right there for a minute, Gary. With the secretary, but not with this team.
Not with the team.
Okay.
John Doble is correct. To the best of my recollection, the concept of overriding royalty did not come up in the context of our trade negotiations. But it did come up between the governor's representative and the assistant secretary.
Well, why did it come up at the table? I mean, I guess I don't understand for sure. Is there two sets of negotiations then? Those
because,
that go on at the table, those that go on in the secretary's office, or what?
What we were negotiating were three things, primarily. The terms and conditions of the land exchange contract, the terms and conditions of the land use stipulations, which are actually an appendix to the contract, and the tract, what's called the tract identification process. Those three things are
I missed one. Land?
Land use stipulations.
Uh-huh.
What were the three? I didn't get the...
Land stipulations.
The land exchange contract, the land use stipulations, and the tract identification process. In other words, how you acquire the oil and gas rights in the coastal plain. Incidentally, Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that John Katz will be shortly forwarding written correspondence to the Assistant Secretary on this very issue, articulating his understanding of how overriding royalty was discussed beforehand.
Are we going to, Bruce, are we going to be talking to John today or not?
No, it hasn't been arranged.
Is that the answer?
Well, I guess what you're saying is that was discussed with the secretary, but that doesn't necessarily mean it was part of the negotiations as far as that goes. But that's one reason you withdrew from the table, because there was no movement on that.
The one thing I should mention is that, I think John would agree with me, is that there were a number of times during negotiations where we would collectively have to stop because the federal negotiation team would say, we are not authorized to go any further because of a policy call.
Was this policy call then stopped like this in at the table with your negotiating team, and is that why you and John Katz went to the to Horn?
On occasion, that would occur, yes, and just as we would have to occasionally check with our policymakers in the governor's office, they would also have to check with theirs.
I see.
Well, were there other issues other than the overriding royalty that were discussed with the secretary but not brought to the table that you said that you were reasons for withdrawing from the negotiations?
Well, the answer to that is I'm sure, yes. I'm not sure I can give you any examples right now, but periodically throughout the process, there were major policy calls that had to go to the assistant secretary.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I could help clarify a little bit the process. Normally, the way we've been negotiating, and I think it's important to understand that the negotiating team simply is representing both the agency and the two assistant secretaries, Assistant Secretary Horn and Assistant Secretary Grile. So there are times that we do have to go forward for policy kinds of advice from the two assistant secretaries. Normally, if an issue is surfaced and we are unable or feel uncomfortable about dealing with it as a negotiating team, we may simply say, you know, that's something we're going to have to take up with the assistant secretaries. That was not the case in the case of the specifics as it relates to overriding royalties. It never came up. It wasn't discussed at the negotiating table. It simply came up in apparently a conversation with the assistant secretary, from what I'm told. Normally what would happen is an issue would come up, it would surface, we would react to it. And if we indicated it was not within our purview, we would take it up with the assistant secretary first, the negotiating team. If we came back to the table and said we've taken it up and it's not something that we're authorized to pursue, then normally a participant would say, well, we'd like to take that up one-on-one with the assistant secretary. Would you have any problem with that? And normally we say no. That's kind of the scenario about in the manner in which normally the negotiations work. In the case of the override, it simply didn't work that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got about three issues here. and I guess... Senator Jones, you had a question you wanted to ask, and then we'll get...
All right.
And here comes the fourth issue.
I'm not going to ask about the caribou, believe me. I want to set up a scenario here. Say the land exchange goes through, say the negotiations go on without the state, and the secretary makes the opinion that they will repeal that part of ANILCA, or suggests that that be repealed, the section that forbids any development in the refuge. But that's all, which would allow it to go ahead with the land exchange in place. And he doesn't repeal the public land orders that involve the refuge. Can that happen? And can the land exchange and the development go ahead without repealing those public land orders?
I suspect that development could go ahead on the privately held lands that would be the subject of the exchange. The prohibition in the secretarial order for lands remaining in federal government would still be in place, so leasing would not be permitted on those lands unless and until the secretary repealed those public land orders. On the other hand, I think it's quite an unlikely scenario that the secretary should he recommend that the 1002 area be opened to oil and gas development, that he would simultaneously not remove whatever secretarial obstacles there are to that oil and gas development that he's recommending for the 1002 area. So I don't see that as a likely scenario. But I think it, if the exchanges went forward, Congress opened the 1002 area to oil and gas leasing and development, but the mineral closure was kept in place for federal lands, then that would preclude mineral development on the federally owned lands, while it could go forward on the privately owned lands that would be the subject of the exchange.
See, but that's the issue, isn't it?
I see that as a real possibility, with Congress allowing just development on the privately owned lands and holding federally owned lands in advance for the refuge itself and for those purposes only.
Well, if Congress would do that, that would be different than the Secretary doing
it. Well, isn't Congress going to have to approve this action of the Secretary?
Yes, he makes a report.
Right.
He makes a report.
And a recommendation.
And a recommendation. Then a bill is structured from that. Is he going to send a bill forward with his report? Do you know?
Senator Cogdill, to the best of my knowledge, there will be no draft legislation that will accompany his decision. And in fact, there is already, in some way, shape, or form, some bills that have been introduced, I believe one by Congressman Young.
And one by Bennett Johnson.
And one by, I believe, Congressman Udall. So there are some bills already
Well, Bennett Johnson has also introduced legislation taking 25% of that royalty already to put into the land, into a federal land exchange pool.
Land acquisition.
Black land acquisition fund, federal.
Mr. Chairman, see, I don't have the warm, cozy feeling that you do about us coming out with whole on this 90-10 situation. The federal side of it has an opposite opinion, and I mean, I hear your side, and I hear their side, and both sides are very convincing. And where that's going to end up in a court situation, it's hard to say. And we're gambling on some real high stakes here, and we're gambling with public domains and so forth, and it means a lot to the people of the entire state. So I wonder if we shouldn't be there with our lands, and I guess this leads into another question. I hope this is all right, Mr. Chairman.
You've got the floor.
All right. If the state goes back to the table,
when?
What do they go back with in the negotiations? What type of lands? What? How much?
I take that as a hypothetical question.
Yes.
The state left the table with where we were in time when we left the table some 3 weeks ago or so. We had received conceptual approval from the Department of Interior for approximately 870,000 acres, Jen, give or take a few thousand. Those were state inholdings within refuges, and one area that was not technically an inholding, but it was immediately adjacent to two federal refuges on the Alaska Peninsula.
That's all refuge land, inholdings and refuges, not parks.
Not parks.
Adjacent to and inholding.
Within or adjacent to components of the National Wildlife Refuge System in Alaska. Five or six refuges. We had also been advancing the possibility of including state inholdings in national parks. And as a matter of fact, the state had completed appraisals of lands in national parks for just that purpose. And we had consistently advanced the possibility of including inholdings in parks in our package. And we're just as consistently advised, as I think John and others have brought out, and Mr. Gilmore, that this trade was not set up in that manner by the federal government. Rather, this was to be just refuge inholdings.
Do you know, John, of course, I guess that's not your department, that's BLM, but when our parks, when is there a reason why they haven't considered the small inholdings within parks as part of the trade package? As I understand, we get down to, we're talking about, there's there's 875,000 acres. There's 1,000,002 on the native side. And it's about 2 million acres that's going to be taken out of the out of any entry and go for this exchange. So if we could get ourselves match to match, where it was 1,000,002 on their side, on the private side or the native corporation side, if we could bring ours up to 1,000,002 with inholdings and parks, if that could be done, then why couldn't we go forward with a 50-50 split on all tracks, that they were all tracks would have a 50-50 split with the state, so that we could protect our overriding royalties, or whatever you want to call it. Now, Duke, to answer in this.
Senator Coghill, perhaps it'd be helpful to indicate kind of where we are in terms of negotiating proposals. As we move forward on these exchanges, they become, obviously, they start to take shape, they take form, and we begin to get to the point where we've got agreement between the parties as to what the proposals look like. At this point, we probably don't have a final cut on the proposals on the part of any of the participants, although we're very, very close with a couple. But there are some instances in the case of at least two of the participants where it's likely there's going to be continuing changes in the way in which we negotiate the size of their proposals, because it's when you look, you can't look at the size of a proposal out of context. You also have to look at the value that that brings to the table. And quite clearly, what some of the participants have attempted to do is they want to bring a minimum amount of acres that carry with it a maximum amount of value. So they come forward to us, they give us a proposal, and there's some indication of what direction and the magnitude of values that might be associated with those inholdings. And in the case of, in fact, just last week, we were still negotiating proposals with some of the native corporations in an attempt to fine-tune that. So I think the position of both the department and the agency at this point is that, you know, we're still open to negotiation on the size and shape of individual proposals. I think Gary's characterization of our interest in Park Service lands is correct, and that's already been spoken to by Bob Gilmore in previous testimony. Looking at it again from an agency perspective, we're not trading park lands, we're trading refuge lands. Park lands are not going to be damaged as a result of opening park lands to oil and gas. It's refuge lands that are going to be impacted by potentially by oil and gas development. So I think the position of the agency, and I think we've been supported in that position by the department at this point, is that our initial efforts should be directed at highly valued and high priority refuge in holdings. And once we have been satisfied that we have met our objective there, then I think clearly the department is willing to look and has indicated a willingness to look at Park Service lands.
Yeah, and I guess this strikes right down the middle of the whole issue. You know, why, you know, what, we're confused and bewildered as to why this is all being done in the basement of the Interior Building. Why can't it be open, scrutinized? Nobody seems to know what that formula is as to what is the value in place, on the risk that's involved. We've never really got into the total structure of the backing out of the if there's no oil up there. And I understand, I go back into my documents, we talked about that in Fairbanks, where we talked about being able to retract yourself away from it if there was no oil. When we go to Kodiak, one of the overriding issues in Kodiak is going to be, have the native communities thought about their heritage fund or their heritage program, where they're trading, giving federal lands back. And what are the elders saying about this? Is it just the people that are running the corporations? And if there is no oil up there on some of these structures, how long have they got to back out? You know what I'm saying, is that there's a whole issue, and I guess it's the time frame from when the secretary makes his recommendation, and when his recommendations goes forward, is going to be basically the key to some of the legislation as to the mineral leasing, as to our overriding royalties, as to what is going to go on in Congress. I think that's one issue that we can set over here. We don't know what the Secretary is going to do, and when we do know, it'll be too late for us to react, because then it'll be a public process. But why can't we hold this land exchange thing back until that has been made, with the option for the state to be able to go back to the table with the native corporations and then start to put the structure together as to the trade? Or is it like these things are kind of linked too closely together because of conservationist movements in the lower 48 and all that? Can you put that on the record?
Senator Coghill, let me speak to both of the issues that you raised. One, I think, again, is a sequence of the timing of events, the public involvement in all of this, and the question about the timing in general. Again, I would refer you to Bill Horn's letter to Representative Cotton, where at least a certain amount of this is discussed, and I'd be more than happy to go into more detail here. The 1002 report will go forward before there is any tract identification up on the Arctic. So we will know what is in the Secretary's final report to Congress. And the contracts, any contracts in agreement in principle that we would reach with the parties, would reflect whatever that recommendation is. And it would also reflect the findings in that report. So if there are environmental protection measures that are built in there, they will be built into this contract.
Okay.
So at that point, we have the report on the table, we have the Secretary's recommendation on the table, and that has been forwarded to Congress. We take all of that information, we incorporate it in the agreements, and we try to reach agreement in principle based on that. And if we have, and we meet the three tests that Gary alluded to, the agreement in principle on the contract, the agreement on the values of the inholdings that are being brought to the table, and the ground rules for identifying the tracts on the Arctic, then we will proceed and set a date, and I will be more than happy to notify each of you personally. Once that date has been set, it has not been set, there have been targets established, and we haven't come close to meeting any of them yet, I can tell you that. And once that does happen, we would identify the tracts. At that point, assuming the native corporations they go through the process, they get to that point, and they select their tracts, and they think they have a proposal that they can take to their shareholders, and they have some reasonable prospect of receiving an affirmative.